Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Enron, WorldCom, Bernie Madoff, Galeon, these are all infamous names in some of the world's largest corporate crimes. We know what they did: corruption, fraud, theft, ethics violations. But do we really understand why? Well, Eugene Soltis is a professor at Harvard Business School, and he wanted to know the answer to that question. Turns out it's more complicated than we think. So he spoke to and corresponded directly with more than four dozen former top executives involved in some of the largest white-collar crimes, including Bernard Madoff and Alan Stanford, former Tyco CEO Dennis Kozlowski, Enron Chief Financial Officer Andy Fastow, ImClone CEO Samuel Waxall, and more and more and more and more. And what he found was very surprising. It's also the subject of his book, Why They Do It, Inside the Mind of the White Collar Criminal. And Eugene Soltis joins us now. Welcome to Radio Boston.
It's a pleasure to be here.
So, I just have to ask, I mean, I have an intrinsic interest in this question, but what got you interested enough to correspond with these white-collar criminals who actually had, they're amongst those who had been caught? Why this question did you want answered?
So I think, like many people following the headlines, it's pretty rare that a week or two will go by and you don't see a headline of some former titan of industry doing something that's just totally shocking. And so one night, actually, this is 8 years ago, late at night, I was personally curious and actually just decided to write a couple of the people who I saw in the headlines. This is personal curiosity. I don't have my academic hat. This isn't as a researcher. So I wrote them, and a couple months later, I started to get responses. Some actually responding to the questions I initially asked, but others, like the former CEO of Tyco, said, I have time now. Come visit me. And I started to take them up on this opportunity to try to see the world a little bit more from their eyes.
Okay. So let's talk for a couple minutes in detail about one of the people that you corresponded with, because he was right there with what may be, you know, the grandfather of them all, the Enron scandal. Just to remind people, back in the year 2000, Enron was, what, the seventh largest firm in the United States? $100 billion market cap. In April 2001, MIT had named Enron the e-business of the year, but of course it collapsed entirely. 20,000 people lost their jobs. $60 billion in market value just vanished due to the corporate malfeasance that went on there. For those people who don't remember or wanted to excise it from their memory. So you spoke with Enron CFO or former CFO Andy Fastow.
Yes.
Now, first of all, what was he like?
He's smart, clever. He's oftentimes in the media, he was painted as this individual that was just behind the scenes helping the CEO and the chairman. But really, he's an extraordinary financier, except the challenge is he was actually trying to be too clever in many instances.
Yeah, I mean, so he served 5 years in prison for his role in the scandal, which included what? Hiding some of Enron's losses, the big losses, they were put off the balance sheet.
Off the balance sheet, right. Yeah. The idea was to really accelerate the good things that were occurring at Enron and feature those and figure out a way to essentially paper over, remove from the balance sheet, temporarily hide or delay the losses.
Okay, so when you talk to him then, I mean, that's just like sort of the tip of the iceberg of what went on in Enron. I mean, people remember they were like creating companies that didn't exist to move money around, things like that. But did Fastow give you any insight into why he did? I mean, he was the CFO. The buck should have stopped with him. I mean, why did he do it?
So Enron is an incredibly complex story of all the financial transactions. But Andy gave one example, which I think helps clarify. And he gives examples. Put ourselves in the position of being back in high school and asking our parents, can we go to a party at our friend's house on Friday night? Our parents say yes, under one condition, that you can't drink any alcohol at the party. You say, sure thing, mom, dad. And they give you their blessing and you go to the party. And you arrive at the party and a buddy of yours, as you enter, offers you a beer and you decline politely, saying, my parents said I couldn't drink, and in deference, I'm not going to have a drink. Then an hour later, another friend comes up to you and says, you know what, I got something new. I actually have this new thing called a beer pill. And it has all the same wonderful effects of creating this intoxication, but you just eat it and swallow it. And so you sit there and think about it, and you're like, oh, I told my parents I wouldn't drink alcohol, but I said nothing about eating alcohol. And so you happily take the pill and get drunk with your friends. And technically, you feel like you're following the rules that you set by your parents. But as we can see, is if you were to drive home after that, you would have all the same detrimental and terrible impact of driving under the influence. Yeah. And that captures the mentality of Enron's executives. Technically trying to find really clever ways to, quote, follow the rules, but in the process, taking the principle and really just stomping on it.
Yeah, completely. I mean, as I hear you explain what the example that Fastow gave you, it sounds like a tortured rationalization for the fraud that they were perpetrating.
The challenge in speaking to many of these executives, these are brilliant, brilliant people in many instances. And the problem is you don't start thinking of these things as gray, ethical, moral dilemmas, but instead you think of them as problems. And you being a clever person needs to try to figure out a solution to the problem where in some instances, there's a good reason why we have regulation. You're supposed to just not do it, yeah. Not find a way to ostensibly go around it in a new, clever way. But that's oftentimes what happens with really smart people.
Well, in the book, you relate that Andy Fastow told you, quote, "I was doing exactly what I was incentivized to do, and we wouldn't have gone through all this trouble if we just wanted to cheat. We were finding ways to get around the rules, but going through a complex process to find loopholes to allow us to do it." And then he says, "I cheated fair and square."
Yeah, I mean, there's a worrisome way of viewing it like that. But in many instances, where people view Enron's failures as being all kind of a charade, there was no underlying business. But that's not true. Most of the violations they ultimately prosecute the executives were really, really technical accounting violations. They ended up, and if you do, you know, thousands and thousands of deals and transactions, you're going to make things that are wrong. And that's ultimately how they prosecuted them. But they were trying to do it in a very clever way, seeing dozens of roadblocks and finding, along with their lawyers and accountants, finding very clever ways around that. And so he tends to see that as fair and square. We might also see that as just a perversion of leadership.
Well, so I wonder how much of this has to do with, the culture at Enron and perhaps in other parts of American industry, American corporate culture, because it sounds like, I mean, you know, the title of the other book and that that movie was The Smartest Guys in the Room, right? Like they all thought they were the smartest guys in the room. And so therefore, by virtue of just that, you know, was it easy for them to think or maybe not even think that what they were doing was unethical, criminal? Like the idea just never even crossed their mind.
Exactly. I mean, one of the things that I learned from this project is we all actually do things that are wrong. For example, we all speed a little bit if you drive.
Speak for yourself.
Well, I'm going to follow you home.
I walk.
I'll walk. Okay. Most people speed. And then they rationalize it as saying everyone else is doing it. The speed limit's too low. I won't get a ticket if I go only 5 miles over the speed limit. But what's really critically stops people is they need to feel what they're doing is harmful. And if you feel what you're doing is harmful, you never even consider that as an option. But the problem is in white-collar crime, people at the time, even really smart executives, don't feel what they're doing is harmful because they don't actually see the victims on the other side of the table. They're distant. They're abstract.
Well, so except ultimately in the case of some of these or many of these crimes, there are victims. I mean, just sticking with Enron here, we were talking about the 20,000 people who lost their jobs when Enron collapsed. Many of those people had their entire retirement savings also vested in Enron, which vanished. I mean, did Fastow ever talk to you about, does he have any feelings, any regrets, any remorse for the pain he caused those people? They are victims of what he did.
This is the part that it took me a while to really appreciate as I was doing these conversations, both with people at Enron, but more broadly, is really the lack of remorse. And that's because it's hard for people to actually identify how their particular action led to the devastation of all these people losing their 401k accounts because they thought they were trying to build an amazing firm. Right? This is part of their image of themselves is to create the world's greatest firm. And so to the extent that people lost their accounts, retirement accounts, as the firm went down. They look at that as also a personal tragedy that what they were building was also going downhill. But actually figuring out how your particular action, how moving this number around on a spreadsheet, how doing this particular deal ends up leading to someone not having a retirement account anymore, it's a very circuitous and there's a lot of steps between that one action and someone losing their account. And it's hard for people to viscerally, I think, feel and realize that.
I have to say, I mean, this is so disappointing to me. Not you, but this realization. Because these guys, I mean, just 2 minutes ago we were saying they thought themselves the smartest guys in the room. And if they're so smart, they can't figure out their role caused this? I mean, this sounds to me like a moral failing in them. They should be smart enough to realize that they destroyed the lives of thousands of people.
I
mean, is there a moral failing here? Is that what we're getting at?
I agree. And this is, I think, a really difficult challenge of people that are in prominent positions to actually, when you're controlling huge enterprises that whose your decisions impact thousands, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of people, to actually remember in the end, kind of in that visceral feeling way, that your decisions today and tomorrow will affect all of them, each individual person, rather than this kind of amorphous mass. But most people, and you can't resonate. An amorphous mass doesn't resonate with you.
So let's talk about then what you learned about how to, you know, to get a sense of checks and balances, for lack of a better term, in the process of doing business in America, especially at these high levels, where, you know, ideally, if those checks and balances are there, people are thinking about the potential ramifications of their decisions. I mean, what did you learn about how we can do that?
Well, I don't think anyone thinks, even when they're doing things quite blatantly wrong, if you're in these prominent positions, you never think that you're going to go to prison. And I think that's one of the huge challenges we face from a regulatory standpoint of trying to create deterrence. You think of, well, that's what those other guys do. That's what those bad guys do. That's not me. Even though the people I'm chatting with in my book, this is them. But even during the course of doing this, they don't see that themselves. We have these very powerful kind of internal mechanisms that protect our self-image. And so the trouble is, well, how do you get people, smart people, to take a step back from just seeing everything as a puzzle and actually see that a lot of the decision-making are actually significant moral and ethical dilemmas that have tremendous ramifications on.
And, I mean, how do you do that? There's got to be structural ways, or I hope there are some structural ways to get that as part of the thinking.
One of the larger solutions that we think a lot about is corporate governance solutions, bringing in independent minds into the boardroom, so to kind of spice it up, bring in different views and opinions. The problem is a lot of times, and Dennis Kozlowski, the former CEO, talked about this when he was convicted of embezzlement, is that he saw a lot of these independent directors really ultimately there to serve him. And so technically these people are independent, but like everyone, many times independent directors still have a vested personal interest of being on the board. It could be well-paying, could be prestigious. So are they going to push back in the way to actually create that independence? But ideally, that's what we want. We want to make the world a little bit more like the classroom, where these decisions during corporate training or business school class are not oftentimes that difficult to resolve. They're oftentimes looks pretty black and white, like something like insider trading. But in the boardroom, these things look a lot more muddled. And it's like, why is that the case? Well, you don't have people deeply reflecting on it. You don't have different points of view being brought in. And probably most critically, you don't have anyone pointing out what the ethical dilemma is initially. We hand it to people, students in the classroom. Executives don't always get that clarity handed to them.
No one's pointing it out to them. This could be ethically problematic. I mean, shouldn't they know? Because there's an example you have in the book of a CEO of, you know, whenever there's something that sort of tingled his spidey sense and he wondered if it was right or wrong, he would actually go to a friend who was independent and outside of the company, a lawyer friend, and say, you know, check this out. Is this okay?
Exactly. So this is the case of Ben Horowitz, who wanted an outside view. And in that regard, that's what protected him, going outside the firm, getting a different point of view outside this small culture within Silicon Valley. And ultimately, it's not because, and as he admits, it's not because he had a better moral compass or was more authentic or better values, but simply he knew when to seek advice.
Yeah.
The problem is many times when people seek advice, they go to their very high-priced, top-notch attorney, rather than the attorney saying, whoa, Eugene, this is not what you value as an individual or firm. What they do is sit down and say, let me come back to you in 3 days and find a way to ostensibly do what you just described as illegal, but in a way that technically is okay. And so that's the problem, is a lot of the institutions and checks and balances actually support what the executive's doing rather than actually providing that pushback.
So let me ask you one last question, because we're almost out of time here. I mean, you are a professor at Harvard Business School, and many, many people point to, you know, places like HBS says, this is where those muscles and habits for doing that self-checking, that soul-searching, that the building the structures that make America's future business leaders, have ethical considerations as part of how they do business, it ought to be crafted and honed in at Harvard Business School. I mean, you see some logic behind that there, right?
And I think we do that. The trouble is that the time they spend thinking about this, it's ultimately 2 years, or in an ethics class, it's 40 or 50 hours in the classroom. They then go, let's say they go work at a bank. That's equivalent to their first 3 days of work. So whatever culture they're now in within their bank or whatever firm they go work overwhelms whatever they've honed very, very quickly. And so this is where one of the challenges that we face is how do you get back that spirit? How do you rekindle yeah. those things that you might have been thinking when you had the time to step back and think? And
one of the challenges. Make it more than one class or have it be a part of every class taken at a business school.
Well, I would like every year or two when people come back for the reunions, if they took a day. That might be a way.
That's a great idea. Well, Eugene Soltis is a Harvard Business School professor. His new book is absolutely fascinating. It's called Why They Do It, Inside the Mind of the White Collar Criminal. Professor Soltis, thank you so much for coming in today. It was really, really interesting to talk with you.
Thank you so much.
Back in a moment. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.